Hi, everyone. I've got a treat for you today. My mentor, Blaine Bartlett, and I joined on Office Hours by Ariel Garten, the co-founder of Muse. And the three of us discussed the practice of quieting our minds and also realizing the mind is a muscle and how we can strengthen our brain. Don't forget to join me on Fridays at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern for my free training. You can text me anytime at 949-298-2905 to join my community and email me for anything you need, david@dmeltzer.com or visit dmeltzer.com/training to register. See you there.
This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook.
Dave Meltzer here with Office Hours. I'm about to introduce Ariel. I was just telling her with Blaine that she was on my Instagram live yesterday and we were in a deep, cool conversation. The Instagram was going crazy over it. I was so interested. And we get to like the last part of it. Her volume went away. I couldn't hear. I asked my last like super question. And we were so deep into the neuroscience of happiness and of ego. It was an amazing conversation. Well, Blaine is my mentor. So I want to get reacquainted first on giving a little bit of background on Ariel so Blaine gets a feel for it. And then maybe we can delve back into the conversation we have with Blaine's input as well, because I think there's a lot that we can learn together.
That'd be wonderful. Cool. I look forward to it.
Awesome. Well, give us a little bit of background on you and what you do in the wellness space.
Hey, my name is Ariel. I am one of the founders of Muse. We make this device. It's a brain sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep. My own background is I was trained in neuroscience. I've worked in neuroscience labs from neurogenesis to Parkinson's disease. I then was a psychotherapist for almost a decade. And along the course of building Muse, have become an expert in understanding the brain and meditation. And so I'm here to talk about brain, meditation, Muse, what it is, how it works, what's going on up here when we engage in the act of meditating, and to jam with y'all.
Right on. Well, I had just started with the idea that it was so frustrating 14 years ago when I started meditating because I couldn't understand the quiet side of it. Like, I didn't understand why I kept getting distracted. I thought I had terrible ADD, or it made it so difficult for me. And then the way that you described it to me, I came up with this epiphany, like, wait a second, it's really meditation is a practice of quieting. It's not being quiet. It's the practice of quieting. And no one's ever articulated that to me the way that you have. So I thought maybe we'd start by some of just the neuroscience behind the three areas of the brain and how they interact with each other and how meditation applies to what our brain is doing.
Sure. I'm going to talk about it a little differently than we talked about it last time. So there's an area in the front of your head here called the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain that is associated with thinking, planning, and higher order processing. It's the part of your brain that really makes us human. It allows us to think and to plan. There's another part of your brain back here, and it's the amygdala. It's the part of your brain that likes to respond when there's something scary. It is the part of your brain that's responsible for your fight or flight. And it's constantly scanning the world, looking for danger, looking for things that could go wrong. And then the amygdala really likes to freak out at real danger, at the potential for danger, and at the perception of danger. And it's kind of like the prefrontal cortex is the parent, the one who can see what's really going on and make wise choices, and the amygdala is the kid that's freaking out at everything that seems to be happening, and it feels out of control, and it wants to gain control. So in a meditation practice, what we're actually doing is we are strengthening the prefrontal cortex, and we're strengthening its ability to downregulate or quiet the amygdala. It's kind of like the parent is able to look around and say, hey, I see what's going on. Shh, it's okay, kiddo, it's okay. So we have this dichotomy between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala. We also have another activity in our brain called the default mode network. And that's the chatter that's constantly going on in our brain. It's the little voice that's constantly telling you things about you that probably are not really helpful or true or useful. It's ruminative, it's chatter, it's you're not good enough, it's all that crap that holds us back in our own minds. And when you start a meditation practice, what you actually see is a downregulation, a decrease in the activity of the default mode network. And that's the network between the prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex. So in both of these cases, you have the prefrontal cortex really down-regulating the unuseful activity inside of your brain.
You know, I love that description. And the amygdala, when I was doing a lot of developmental work around emotional intelligence, the amygdala compared to the prefrontal cortex, which is the management center of the brain, as you described there, the amygdala processes information about 20,000 times faster than what the prefrontal cortex does. Round numbers, mm-hmm. So this is where we get the fight or flight. This is where we get the reactive dynamic. And from a business perspective, and that's part of what we look at in this particular office hours segment, is the implications to business and how we move away from the soul of the business through our reactive processes. So the ability to be able to step into and quiet, to practice a quieting modality can recalibrate and put back in the seat of power that which belongs in the seat of power. The amygdala doesn't necessarily, because I'm not facing a saber-toothed tiger today. So what kind of, and I know that you probably mentioned this in your Instagram talk, but I'd be curious here, just in terms of people listening today, what are some real quick things that people could do in 5 minutes to just regain control when the amygdala hijack occurs?
Sure. So if the amygdala triggers fight or flight, there's an equal and opposite response called the rest and digest, the parasympathetic nervous system, that's activated by the vagus nerve. And there are a few really easy ways to activate the vagus nerve. One is by breathing. So when you breathe in a diaphragmatic breath, a breath into your belly, you actually mechanically tug on your vagus nerve and signal it to start activating and calm your body down. So that's why you're often told to take deep belly breaths, breathing deeply through your stomach, because it literally triggers your vagus nerve to do the opposite reaction to fight or flight. And it triggers your body to start to slow right down. The way you breathe and the rate of breath is also key. So as you breathe in, your heart rate increases. As you breathe out, your heart rate decreases. So if you can spend time in extended out breath, you can actually spend more time in a time when your body is relaxing and signaling to the rest of your body that relaxation is okay, this lowering heart rate. That's why often you'll hear breathing patterns like 4 breaths in, 6 breaths out. And that is to slow and calm your body. So those are two really easy ways to instantly move your body from fight or flight into rest and digest.
That's so awesome. I'm going to screw this whole thing up because I'm just piqued with curiosity. I wonder how all of this, works within the quantum materialization of matter. Meaning, I believe that the mind itself, mm-hmm. all three areas of the mind, and I'd love to hear someone who understands neuroscience, not theoretical mumbo jumbo woo-woo stuff like me, but I believe that I'm a projector, which means that if I can control this process of thinking, that then I actually can project or perceive and materialize. Is there anything scientifically that supports the idea of manifestation, materialization, projection into that quantum state that we actually can see, hear, touch, or feel?
That's a super awesome question. And that's not the area of neuroscience that I work in. I work in the much more mechanical.
But anyway, I want your biggest guest.
How I look at it from a purely material sense, and there may be many, many other layers in which to look at this energetically and otherwise, looking at it purely materialistically, if you say, I want to make $100 million or I want a red sports car, you will invariably start putting your attention towards the things that will get you there. You will invariably start making decisions that will move you closer and closer to a red sports car. Your attention will move towards it. So all of a sudden, anytime you see a red car on the road, it's like all of a sudden there are hundreds of red sports cars that you'd never noticed before. They were there the entire time, but you hadn't chosen to put your attention on it, and you hadn't put your intention into it. So this act of attention and intention is really key, both potentially from an energetic manifestation standpoint and from an incredibly practical material standpoint, because as soon as I put my attention on something, that's where I put my energy. That's where I put my focus. That's what I literally tell my brain to attend to and make happen. And our brains are amazing computational machines. They will want to go where you direct it, but so often we don't bother directing our brain.
Yeah.
And practices like meditation and intention setting and goal setting and manifestation get into the process of directing our brain, which both moves our attention and potentially something more energetic into that direction.
So attention plus intention does equal coincidence, see?
And
if you would have scientifically proven the answer to my question, we would have all automatically presented you with the Nobel Prize.
Yes.
Just like Planck and Einstein and others. But that we're on a good path at least. Okay. Go ahead, Blaine. I know you had something there.
This inner voice that you talked about, what was the term that you used for that?
Default mode network, DFN.
The default mode network. In some of the work that I do, and David is also, very deep and steeped into this, around controlling that inner voice. It's that 3 o'clock in the morning voice. Yeah, and this kind of fits right in with the intention, attention, and notion. I've been meditating since about 1976. Actually, a little bit, back that truck up. About 1972, I think it was, when I first started. And quieting that inner voice, has been a very interesting process. It just does not seem to shut up. So the goal of meditation is not to become quiet. The goal of meditation is quietness. Yeah, if I understand this in the way that you're framing it. How can one gain control, if it's possible here, of that default mode so that the voice that I'm hearing is one that is consistent with what I'd like to see? And this is the intention, attention thing. That voice that I'm hearing is feeding into what it is that I say I'd like to see manifested in my world.
Sure. So meditation on one level is retraining the brain, and it is a consistent practice to train the brain. So one of the first things we learn in meditation is observation. Mm-hmm. So in a focused attention meditation, you put your attention on your breath. As soon as you have a thought that comes up, you notice that you have a thought, which for most people is mind-blowing because we just have a brain that thinks. And so as soon as you notice you have a thought, you say, hey, I don't want my mind to go onto that thought. I want it to come onto something neutral, my breath. And that's really the pivotal moment where you say, I'm not going to have a brain that just does its own thing and runs itself like we all assume our minds do. I'm going to actually choose the contents of my own mind. And I'm going to choose not to follow this thought right now, not to give it energy, not to give it attention or intention. I'm going to choose to take my brain elsewhere. And you could put it on something neutral, or you could put it onto a mantra, something positive like I'm good enough, et cetera, et cetera. And you do that process repeatedly. And as you repeat that process over and over, you are retraining your brain to say, nope, we don't need to go there anymore. We can stay here. We can stay focused on the thing that we care about. We can stay focused in the here and now. So part of the process is our wandering thoughts are typically about the past or the future. It's like, I don't need to be in the past or the future. I can just choose to be in the present, the here and now. Part of the process is choosing the contents of your thought. I don't want that kind of thought. I want this thought. Let me put my brain there instead. And then it is the repetition over and over and over again. And as you do that over time, the voice quiets because you've trained your brain not to go there. And you've trained your ability to sustain your attention on the thing that you care about, to keep your eye on the prize. And the prize could be as simple as present moment awareness, or it could be, the thing that you're trying to achieve in your life, or a new inner dialogue that you're attempting to condition.
Yeah, that's beautiful. The neurophysiology that comes into play with that practice, and it's kind of steeped in the notion that the mind is the body and the body is the mind. So when I have a thought, there's a biochemical reaction. Hormones are secreted, and all this kind of electrical impulses are triggered. I think, I feel. And then all of a sudden, I've got this fascinating little loop going on. So what you're suggesting here through this practice is we interrupt that practiced, habituated link, and it opens up different possibilities. And it begins with noticing.
It begins with noticing and making a different choice.
Yeah.
Interrupting the conditioned response and choosing a different response.
So for me, one of the most fascinating things about the brain is the capacity that I think we don't even or can't even fathom, even scientists can't fathom, the power that we harness, right? I talked and tried to inspire people to allow themselves to feel or to liberate the power that we're connected to. And I think the brain itself is a true proof of the power that we have inside of us. And so I would love to, number one, know, in comparison to a Watson supercomputer, what capacity our brain has comparatively to the biggest supercomputer that we've created. And then two, how energy itself is utilized within the brain.
Sure. So the brain is incredibly complex. We have not been able to effectively map the brain. We don't know how it works. You know, we are able to compute things that computers are not able to compute. We are still able to come up with answers in ways that computers are unable to do so. Mm-hmm. So there is something going on in our brain that we haven't been able to really pin down. And so the brain is still the most extraordinary supercomputer there is. When you talk about energy, what are you thinking? Because there are a few different ways to interpret energy. One
I'm thinking the actual power,
which is
the actual kilowattage of what the brain has. It, like, because I really believe, you know, we have, to me, the physical proof, right? I'm a mathematical person. I love physical proof. The physical proof that I'm connected to the greatest source of energy, light, love, and lessons is the amount of kilowatts that are flowing through my body. But yet I think that we, whether or not we can register or not, there must be like this extraordinary amount of kilowattage in our brain. And it's so efficiently used too. So, you know, if you understand power, it's one thing to have extraordinary amount of power, but to use that power efficiently takes on exponentiality to what you can manifest or do with that brain. So I was curious if you had ever, or anyone had ever studied that pure just kilowattage of power energy that we harness within the brain itself.
Oh, that's an awesome question. So you can look at it from the level of calories, like how many calories does the brain consume? Because the consumption of calories is a marker of energy. Mm-hmm. The brain consumes a lot of calories, but I don't think that's exactly what you're thinking. You can look at it in terms of the number of neural connections, because when neural connections fire with one another, it is an energetic firing. So it's an electrochemical response. You have ions that flow through the neuron, which carry an electrical charge from one neuron to the other, and you can actually measure the electrical value of the brain. So that's another way to look at it. Then you can look at it from the energy that's created in the brain. So ATP, adenosine triphosphate, is the energy currency of the brain, and that's how we actually move the energy that we consume, the calories that our brain consumes, that's how it works. Then there's a whole other level of energy which has not been identified and discussed in the way, which is like, what is the potential of all that our brain can do when it connects to something greater? And those, again, are answers that people do not know. But these are amazing questions. I love it.
Again, I'm voting for you to win the Nobel Prize with these questions. Oh, well, you are an amazing person. We are so aligned with what you do, and to seek and to understand what, you know, you're pursuing in your venture. And we will get more into the product side of how that's tracking and monitoring what we do in the meditation. Where can people find you and the product?
You can find out more about Muse at choosemuse.com. And you can find me on the internet at choosemuse and Ariel's Musings.
Awesome. You are amazing. We appreciate you. We look forward to having you right back on.
Hey, podcast listeners. Thank you for listening, as always, to today's episode. I know you've been enjoying the Road to Revenue episodes. They are downloading at record paces, and I am so grateful for you joining me, not only on the podcast, but live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern. Make sure you email me at david@dmeltzer.com or text me at 949-298-2905. Thank you so much.